Okay, so this morning session is on dementia, and I suppose that's really helpful in terms of, I know you will have awareness of dementia. Some of you have done, I know some of you have done dementia topics in terms of your honours projects as well. So you'll have a level of knowledge, and obviously through the programme you have kind of modules which touch on dementia. But I suppose it's really helpful in terms of, because we have Alzheimer's Scotland coming in, and your case study is on a client with dementia, then it's helpful to have a bit of a reprisal of what some information on dementia diagnosis, but also kind of going into a wee bit more detail and looking at some of the policy. So we'll talk about some of the policies and some of the assessments that are used with people with dementia, and some useful strategies. I've also got a couple of tasks, individual tasks and group tasks for you to do, so that you're not listening to me all day, or at least for an hour and a half. So we will get started. So dementia is an umbrella term used to describe a range of brain diseases characterised by a progressive decline in intellectual and other mental functions. So we'll see later on that there are a broad range of dementias, and we'll speak about some of them, some of the causes, some of the unique challenges that they present to people who live with dementia. Whilst Alzheimer's disease and vascular disease are the most common causes, there are a number of other less common forms of dementia, and dementia is a terminal condition. Now, whilst dementia is a terminal condition, what they mean by that is that you will have it, and if you live long enough, then you will eventually die from dementia. But I think the stats say that you're more likely to die from something else rather than dementia. So you're more likely to die from perhaps heart disease or a stroke or something else, cancer, than you are actually from dementia. So whilst it's terminal, more often than not, it's not dementia that you actually die from, if that makes sense. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay, great. Dementia is a group of progressive diseases of the brain that slowly affect all functions of the mind and lead to a deterioration in the person's ability to remember, reason and concentrate. It can affect every area of human thinking, feeling and behaviour. So in terms of understanding dementia, it affects different parts of the brain. So in terms of if the different types of dementias have impacts on different areas of the brain, in terms of the parietal lobe, when dementia affects the parietal lobe, then you have difficulty processing visual information, problems recognising faces, objects, impaired spatial awareness, so proprioception, difficulty with sequencing of tasks, which is, you know, really important when it comes to complex tasks, and it's a really important thing for us to bear in mind as occupational therapists, and it can affect the body sense. In terms of the temporal lobe, that then causes problems with people understanding and producing speech, so expressive and receptive dysphasia, difficulty with people remembering recent effects, recent memories. It tends to be the longer term memories that are maintained longer, so they tend to stick with people, but the short term memories, they're more elusive to people, and people have a reduced attention span as a result of damage. In terms of the frontal lobe, what you tend to recognise with the frontal lobe is people become a bit disinhibited, so they're probably a bit more over-familiar, or they might swear, they just have a lack of social cues, they've reduced initiation in terms of tasks, initiating tasks, difficulty with reasoning, problems making choices for themselves, and impaired planning and abstract thinking. So the executive function is impacted. So that is a picture of what, on the left hand side, is what a healthy brain looks like, and on the right hand side is a picture of what someone with advanced Alzheimer's disease looks like. So there's a marked change in terms of the health of the brain. So as we said before, there are numerous different types of dementia. These are the most common types of dementia in Scotland. Around 55-60% of the people who have dementia have Alzheimer's disease, and that's the one we tend to think about when we think about dementia. We tend to think about Alzheimer's disease. 20% roughly have vascular dementia. 10% have Lewy body dementia, and 15% are made up of other dementias, such as things like Korsakoff psychosis, which is when people have drink alcohol and it depletes their vitamin B1, and it causes problems with their brain and memory. So Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia. It's a degenerative disease affecting the brain tissue, including the loss of and damage to nerve cells in the brain, the neurons. This shrinkage to the brain due to cell loss can be seen on brain scans. Post-mortem studies have found development of tangled bunches of nerve fibres and deposition of abnormal plaques between the nerve cells. The tangles and plaques disrupt normal conduction of messages within the brain. Gradual impairment of cognitive and intellectual functions, e.g. memory loss, and problems with learning new information. Alzheimer's, as the disease progresses, symptoms include impaired judgment, loss of language skills, reduced concentration, altered sleeping pattern, impaired physical coordination, personality changes, changes to mood and behaviour, so people's mood can become quite labile, disorientation to time. There's no single cause that's been identified, and actually recently there's been some things in the news, I don't know if you've seen it, in terms of footballers, a lot of old footballers from the generations where the footballs were really heavy and the balls would get sodden with kind of water. You know, people heading balls, they actually think there might be a link to that with dementia. People playing rugby, there's been a lot of discussion around about rugby and head kind of trauma, and American football as well. So there's kind of a lot of discussion right now about things that might impact on dementia and what might be causing the massive increase in people who are diagnosed. The possible influence of age, genetic inheritance, environmental factors, diet and overall general health continue to be explored. So they think it's a multifaceted thing. As with most health conditions, it's no one thing. It's a cumulative effect. There's no cure. The drug treatment focuses on controlling the symptoms and slowing down the disease progression, e.g. Cognitive enhancers or cholinesterase inhibitors, I always struggle to say that, which they basically help people who have Alzheimer's have reduced levels of acetylcholine in their brain. So the cholinesterase inhibitors, they help to increase acetylcholine in the brain, which helps people, their brains process information. Vascular dementia is the second most common type of dementia after Alzheimer's disease. Vascular dementia is thought to be due to damage from vascular systems in the brain, causing blood to be cut off from brain cells, leading to brain death. We used to call this, when I was training, we used to call this multi-infarct dementia. So it's the kind of idea almost like, it's almost like the like mini strokes, the idea of basically bits of the brain are cut off from blood and oxygen, and therefore the brain tissue dies. It's categorised into different types depending on the nature of the vascular disease, so depending on the severity, so whether it's a major stroke or whether it's a transient ischemic attack. Risk factors include high blood pressure, heart problems, high cholesterol and diabetes, all of which we specialise in Scotland. Signs and symptoms, it tends to be an abrupt onset, which we would imagine in terms of if it is related to cardiovascular issues. Step progression to the disease, symptoms remain stable and then a sudden deterioration. So I used to always see it was like a sudden falling off a cliff, and then it would plateau, and then fall off a cliff, and then plateau again. So there, it can result in patchy cognitive deficits, focal neurological signs and symptoms, fluctuating functioning for people, emotional lability, so people's mood goes up and down, and their mood sometimes incongruous to what actually is going on around them. I remember being out the first time I'd worked on stroke, and there was a gentleman, he just burst into tears and he was just crying, and I was really distressed and worried about him, and it turned out it was actually a symptom of his dementia, that he was actually it was emotional lability. There was actually nothing at that time, external stimuli, that was causing him to be upset. But it's a really, really difficult thing to deal with and to witness. In terms of vascular dementia, insights retained longer than Alzheimer's. Treatment includes medication for underlying conditions such as stroke, so things like blood thinners, treatments to help people reduce their blood pressure, and medication that reduces cholesterol, because we know we all have a link to cerebrovascular accidents and TIAs. Dementia with Lewy bodies shares characteristics with both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. Basically, what happens with Lewy bodies, there are tiny spherical proteins, deposits, called Lewy bodies in the nerve cells in the brain, and they interrupt the action of chemical messengers, so they interrupt the signal getting between the brain and other parts of the body. Researchers are unsure why they occur and how they cause damage. Common symptoms, dementia with Lewy bodies has common symptoms with Alzheimer's, but in this type of dementia, people can have visual hallucinations. They can have stiffness and trembling, so they can have intention trembling. They can have loss of facial expressions, tendency to shuffle while walking, as seen as in Parkinson's. The memory is typically less affected in Alzheimer's, and the treatment includes using drugs to control Parkinson's type symptoms and some of those used in Alzheimer's. So things like L-DOPA and things like that can be used. Unlike Alzheimer's, the damage is focused on the temporal lobe area of the brain, which results in a disturbance to behaviour and personality, disinhibition and restlessness, people having poor coordination, uncaring and unsympathetic attitudes can occur, which, as you can imagine, would be really difficult for users and carers. The apathy and impaired speech can result in clients having difficulty planning, a loss of language skills. Sometimes repetitive and ritualistic behaviours can occur, such as hoarding and gluttony. People with frontotemporal dementia can lack insight. In terms of the treatment, the treatments that would be traditionally given to people with Alzheimer's are actually contraindicated. They can actually make the symptoms worse. So it's more about understanding, helping the person to understand the behaviour changes, helping the family to understand the behaviour changes, and really kind of doing a lot of education to try and reduce the level of expressed emotion. So in terms of families' attribution for why their loved ones are behaving in this way, if there's education round about that, if the families understand that this is part of their illness, then there's a different perception of that. So if you think someone's deliberately doing something to you, or being deliberately rude or ignorant, then you'll have an emotional reaction to that, whereas if you realise it's part of a condition, then you're much more likely to be sympathetic, and therefore it reduces the level of stress for you and the client. So in terms of whilst there are different types of dementia, there are a wide range of different types of dementia, even within the diagnostic categories, you've got to remember that everyone's dementia is different. The course of the illness varies from individual to individual. So depending on how engaged the person is with treatment, in terms of genetic factors, in terms of their diet, in terms of their exercise, the progression of the illness is very different. There's only a handful of drugs available, and it doesn't just affect the family and the person. Obviously, it has a massive impact on the family. Families and systems. So what happens to one person affects everyone, so it has a ripple effect. Research is ongoing in terms of dementia. I think recently it's become a big priority in Scotland, so there's been more impact in terms of research. Still not enough, I would argue, but it is improving, and there still continues to be a stigma and lack of understanding. But I think as we continue to shine a light on dementia and the challenges that people face, and in terms of Scotland wanting to be, a centre of a place of excellence in terms of dementia treatment, then the stigma is likely to decrease just through increased contact, increased awareness, and the fact that it may well happen to you one day. Cheery thought, I know. Dementia can lead to a poor or diminished quality of life for the person, their families, and informal carers. Living with dementia can bring anxiety, embarrassment, worry and fear, and it can lead to isolation and depression. So that really resonates with us as OTs. So our job is in terms of engaging people with their occupations to try and maintain their health and well-being, to try and keep them having links with their community, to educate them and their family how to manage these conditions, how to reduce levels of stress. So really there's a huge role for occupational therapists there. So in terms of getting you to think about some of the anxieties that might happen or might occur for people with dementia, in terms of the everyday tasks and how everyday simple tasks become really difficult for people with dementia, what I want you to do now, on your own, without looking at your phones or taking money out of your pocket, I want you to draw two circles, and I want you to draw a penny piece for the Singaporeans, whatever your equivalent of the lowest coin, the lowest denomination coin. What would that be in Singapore? 5 cents. So without looking, I want you to draw the front and the back for the Scottish and British of a penny, and for the Singaporeans a 5 cent. Without looking, without discussing, this is an individual task. So on your own. No cheating, no looking. On your own. How often do you see a penny piece or a 5 cent? All the time? Yes, absolutely. It's also going to form part of your ACE3 assessment later on. That's a tiny piece. That's like the most parsimonious drawing I've ever seen in my life. Like, in Microdot. Do you remember Microdot? You're too young for Microdot. You're too young. Do you not remember? In libraries before there was like CD-ROMs and databases, they used to put things onto really small writing. And you would have basically have like a magnifying thing that would go over it so they could store lots of files in a smaller space. So we'd put it in really tiny and you would move it like in a microscope over it. Yeah, Microdot.
What is that?
Yeah, how'd you go?
I think it's like
you got it. Well, you've got it, Bob. You said you're not working in Queen's
Hotel. There's some light.
There was a really good tails up the back. I'm not embarrassed, the person with the really good tails. But there was excellent. There were some rather creative examples. So, what I would like you to do now in pairs is just think about, how did you feel when I asked you to carry out that task? What was your first thought? What was the first thing you tried to do in terms of remembering and kind of recalling that memory of what a penny piece or a 5 cent or a euro looked like? What emotions did you feel as you went through the exercise? What did you learn from this? And how do you think this exercise might be related to someone who's living with dementia? Think about how hard you found it to remember something so simple and something you use every day and you've literally seen thousands of times. How do you think a person with dementia feels when they forget things that they've done day and daily or forget people's faces that they've seen for years? Okay, so I'd like you to discuss that in pairs and then we'll get some feedback. Or threes, in your case. Don't expect it to move. So easy, I should know this.
But you don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anyone else? How did other people feel? What if I'd made this a part of an assessment? What if I had got you to bring these out to the front? How would you have felt then?
I was really frustrated.
You were really?
Genuinely.
Were you really? Right, okay. So what, kind of with yourself or?
Were you frustrated
with me?
I was like, my queen's the wrong way round.
It's
terrible.
Is that not like treason? To have the queen the wrong way round? It's upside down, isn't it? So you felt frustrated?
Yeah.
Frustrated with yourself?
Yeah.
Frustrated with the level of challenge of the task as well?
Just frustrated with my brain.
Just frustrated with your brain? Frustrated with me? For asking you to do it?
Yeah.
Maybe?
No,
less.
But probably, if an assessment said probably, not right there, but if it wasn't.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. How can you relate that to working with people with dementia?
You probably feel like that when you ask them to do everything.
Absolutely, absolutely. And things that So you ask them to do things that they've done day and daily for years and years, that think they're really, really simple, and then they can no longer do it. And it becomes, you know, that you can imagine the frustration, can't you? The embarrassment, the frustration. It'd be really, really difficult. How can you use that in terms of, as a clinician, what can you be mindful of, what can you be cognizant of when you're working with people with dementia? If they're feeling embarrassed and, you know, and frustrated. Sorry? Be sure? Absolutely. Yep. How would you do that?
To move on to the next question.
Yeah, Give them a bit of time. Yep. Kind of, you know, sometimes kind of, you know, basically kind of not kind of make light of the situation, but kind of say it's okay, you know, you relate it to something you've done, you know, it's okay, I forget things all the time, you know, and kind of, you kind of normalise it to a certain extent, whilst it's not that normal. Yeah?
The one I always get to do is tell them, be like, oh, it's like when you walk into the kitchen to get something, then you just stop in the middle of the floor and you forget what you're in.
Absolutely. Like,
oh, I do that all the time.
Yeah, me too. It's partly something to do with the room that you originate, the thought. So once you leave that room, you then forget, because the process began. So if you're in the living room and you're walking into the kitchen to get something that originates in the living room, you remember well in your living room, then when you walk into the kitchen, it's like, well, what was that in here for? Yeah, that happens to me all the time. Yeah. That happened to other people? Can you imagine that happening frequently and, you know, and not even having to leave the room, even within the same sentence, within the same process, within the same discussion? You almost, that fog coming down, I think sometimes people with dementia describe it, it's a shutter coming down in terms of the thought process, and it's just, you know, it just goes completely blank. I've had that kind of mid-sentence, and you're like, you know, it's like you almost take yourself down a blind alley. You imagine that happening all the time, or frequently anyway. That would be really distressing. So I think, empathy, you know, giving people a bit of time, you know, showing understanding, showing compassion, can really be really, really helpful to de-stress. And I think sometimes when I used to carry out assessments with people, particularly AMPS assessments, used to say things like, you can't pass or fail, you know, which is really reassuring. It's not something you can pass or fail. It's just about looking at the level you're at, which people used to find quite reassuring.
I think it's sometimes quite good to stay away from the word assessment as
well, because
that's something
you stress to people. Yeah, good point. Yeah. That's a really good point. So what could you say?
Well, I don't know, like, so I'm based in social work, so now we do like that SSA assessment.
Yep. Absolutely. Or a chat, or I think sometimes psychology talk about getting to know you. You know, feel like I want to burst into song when you say that. You know. But yeah, absolutely, I think that's a really good point. Yeah, getting away from assessment, just about fact finding, about having a discussion, about getting to know you. Yeah, absolutely. Just going to see what you do just now. I'm just going to see how you get on just now and what level you're at, and just to kind of see how we can help you. Absolutely. I think that's a good point, staying away from the word assessment, although it's easier said than done, though, isn't it? Yeah, but no, I totally agree with you, though. So in terms of dementia, about 93,000 people, according to the latest estimate, live with dementia in Scotland. And it's not just people over the age of 65, although as you get older, the likelihood of you having dementia increases rapidly, but there are 3,200 people under the age of 65 that have a diagnosis of dementia. I think the last time I looked, the detection rate is about, so whilst it's 93,000 people that think they've got dementia, I think there's only about two-thirds of those that have been actually diagnosed, so they're looking all the time to try and increase the detection and the diagnosis of dementia. And it's predicted to double over the next 25 years, partly due to the increase in detection, but also due to the change in the demographic within the age group. So, you know, people who were born after the Second World War, baby boom generation, people living longer, fewer people being born, the demographic is changing. So, it's predicted that that number will go up to 186,000 in 25 years' time. So if you're 65 to 69, then you have a 1.3% chance of having dementia, and it doubles every 5 years up to 80. So 85 to 90, it's a fifth of the population have dementia. And approximately 63%, so nearly two-thirds live in private households, compared with 36.5% living in care homes. The shift of that, and that, I think that will continue to shift in line with the 2020 vision and the Scottish Government policy, which is about people living in homely or home in their home or in homely environments. Approximately 70-80% of care home residents have a diagnosis of dementia. So a few facts. Costs associated with dementia are around £1.7 billion per year in Scotland. Health and social care policy supports people to remain in their own homes as long as safely possible, and that will be part of your job as an occupational therapist, will be to be involved in that assessment of risk of people's your level of independence. People living with dementia are three to eight times more likely to fall. Currently, around one in four of all general hospital beds in Scotland are occupied by people over the age of 65 who have some form of dementia. So there is a huge kind of fiscal impact as well as a massive psychological and emotional impact of dementia. So in terms of the policy, there's been a lot of policy in Scotland round about dementia, which was really kicked off in 2009 with the Charter of Rights. So really looking to move on giving people rights in terms of, so increasing the awareness of the rights of people with dementia and users and carers who have dementia. In 2010, there was the first national dementia strategy, which spoke of five challenges, but the priorities were care in general hospital and improving diagnosis rates to promote early diagnosis. The standards of care for dementia in Scotland, which we'll talk about in the next slides coming up, promoting excellence. So that was really looking about. Did anyone watch the dementia training that was put on? Yeah. Okay. So that's part of the promoting excellence. So it's about giving people increased levels of training. People who, and it's a stepped approach. So depending on the level of intervention, depending on your level of qualification, then there's a stepped approach to the level of training. So that was something that was implemented in 2011. 2013, Scotland's second national dementia strategy came up with 17 new commitments, but a lot of these build on the 2010 policy. And there is in the process of coming up with the third dementia strategy, which was actually due at the end of last year, but has been delayed. I haven't seen the rationale for it being why it's been delayed, but it was due to be published at the end of 2016. But when I was doing research for this class, it's still to be published. So, in terms of the standards of care for dementia, it was developed to help people with dementia and their carers understand their rights and make sure they receive the support they need. So, kind of moving on from people being, you know, appreciative or basically grateful for whatever they get, it's actually very much you're couching it in terms of you have a right to this, you should expect this, and that's massively important. In terms of if people don't know the rights, then they tend not to actually have those rights respected. So there's a big drive round about people with dementia, carers of people with dementia, really kind of getting a real sense of what the rights were and having statements round about that. The framework outlines the skills and knowledge health and social care staff should have depending on the role they play. So, standards of care for dementia. So, people with dementia have a right to diagnosis. People with dementia have the right to be treated as a unique individual with dignity and respect. People with dementia should expect a wide range of different treatments and support. People with dementia should be supported to be independent as long as possible and included in their community, which aligns with the Scottish Government 2020 vision. Carers should be well supported and educated, and people with dementia should have end-of-life care that respects their wishes. So there's a kind of emphasis in there of planning for end-of-care. So people in the early stages, hence why it's really important to have early detection and diagnosis, so that people can actually start to plan whilst they're lucid enough to do so. So early diagnosis is helpful because it enables caregivers to be better equipped to cope with the disease progression. It provides people with dementia with the opportunity to make decisions about their financial and legal affairs before they lose the ability to do so. And it gives people with dementia a better chance to benefit from existing treatments. So we know that early intervention is really important, you know, across different health conditions. You know, the level of input required at an early stage is less, and it has a bigger impact in terms of the prognosis. And it's the same for people with dementia, people living with dementia. So in terms of diagnosis and enabling increased detection of dementia, diagnosis is multidisciplinary, so it would be part of nursing assessment, occupational therapy assessment, social work assessment, psychiatry assessment. In terms of OTs, we would use a functional assessment such as an AMPS. Is everyone, put your hands up if you're familiar with an AMPS assessment, because I've spoken about it a couple of times. Okay, a couple of people not. Okay, what an AMPS assessment is, it's based on the MOHO, it's a MOHO assessment, and what happens is that you go and you are you go to training and you're calibrated in AMPS. So it looks at, if I remember rightly, 16 motor skills and 20 process skills. And what you get is people get a score between 1 and 4 for that. And what happens is because you go to training and you're calibrated and there's a computer program, then presumably if I'm AMPS calibrated, if one of you were to go and train in AMPS, you're calibrated, then I would score the person the exact same way as you would once it goes through the computer program. Does that make sense? So there's a calibration. So you might score them differently on each individual criteria, but the computer program allows for that. And then both our scores should actually come out the same. So there's then a graph looking at the level of independence in terms of their motor skills and their level of skills in terms of process skills. Does that make sense? Yeah. So basically, it's a standardised assessment, really, really strong, really well researched standardised assessment. And in terms of cognitive assessments as well, the ACE3 I've actually checked. It's free to access. So if you want to have a look at that, you can download that and print it off. It's free. That's one of the ACE3 is a iteration of the ASA. I think it was 2012 ACE3 came out. That's one of the commonly used, it's Adam Brooks cognitive exam. That's one of the kind of commonly used.
I was just
going to
say, recently I found there's a Glasgow Uni online module for right. It's like free and it's for it's like 2 hours.
Oh,
is
it?
Like that, but you can just get it online and it just goes to the Glasgow Uni website and type in ACE.
See if you send me that link, I'll post it up on that'd be really helpful, thank you very much, that's great. It's a fairly, I wouldn't say lengthy assessment, I think it takes about 15-20 minutes, but there's some drawing involved in that as well, and there's things like number tasks and how many animals you can recite in a certain period of time. And also in terms of occupational therapists, carry out a home assessment. So even if you're not AMPS calibrated, you'll still carry out a home assessment, looking at people's, ADL skills, their ability to carry out tasks at home. So that all links towards the diagnostic criteria.
Okay, see how the AMPS assessment, how long does that take to administer?
An AMPS assessment it really depends on the task. So in terms of AMPS, there are tasks which are really, really difficult. So something like cleaning the bathroom would be kind of a higher level task, whereas it might be something like putting the bed sheet, the duvet back on the bed. So it depends on the task, but what you would do with an AMPS assessment is you would carry out at least two different tasks, ADL tasks, And they're prescribed, so the different types of tasks. So you actually go out with a manual and you say it's something like making tea and toast, and they have to use one spread, and they have to, you know, there's so many things that they have to do, and that then ensures that those motor and process skills are engaged in that task.
And how do you find that works with dementia? Does it work very well?
I haven't used it with dementia, but I've used it with a lot of people with mental health problems who have had similar, you know, concentration, cognitive deficits. It worked well because it highlights the problems. You know, if people are, so there's things like notice and responding, that's one of the big things. So if you don't notice the toast burning, for example, then that's, you know, an issue. If you have to intervene, then that's a serious thing, whereas if they notice it after a bit of a delay. So it works really well with people with dementia because they tend to have quite profound deficits. I suppose, do you mean maybe do they understand the task, or do they?
It's quite a lengthy assessment.
Doesn't need to be a lengthy assessment. Yeah, and you can break it up, so it depends. You can maybe go out, explain what it is, do one task, and then come out another day and explain it, do the other task, yeah. But it should be a task that they're familiar with, so it shouldn't be an unusual task. If it's an unusual task, it's an unfair assessment. You know, it should be a familiar environment as well, so it should be their own home in terms of getting the kind of most accurate assessment. So Alzheimer's Scotland developed the five pillars model, and this has been used in terms of people at the early stages, so people have just been diagnosed with dementia. So it's looking at supporting people to maintain and enhance community connections, looking at peer support, helping people to plan for future care whilst they still have the cognitive capacity to do so, helping people to understand their illness and managing symptoms, including carers, and planning for future decision making. So that's been widely embraced, and that was developed in kind of connection or in co-production with users and carers. In terms of the early stages, the impact upon our client's functional abilities, decreased knowledge of recent occasions or current events, so short-term memory problems, decreased capacity to perform complex tasks such as meal planning, paying bills and managing finances, a reduced memory of their own personal history. The client may seem subdued and withdrawn, especially in social or mentally challenging situations, so they may kind of slightly disengage. Sometimes the early symptoms of dementia can seem like depression, but that doesn't mean that they might not be depressed. There's a high comorbidity with dementia and depression, but they can seem like, you know, maybe they're just a bit disengaged, maybe they're just a bit depressed. But that whole thing about, you know, the subdued and withdrawn, that's about a difficulty in terms of processing the amount of information. So you think about, we're going to do a task later on that's going to hopefully highlight that for you, in terms of the difficulty mentally processing when there's a lot of stimuli. Mental symptoms and medication. So as an OT, you might be the one person, you might be the key worker, or you might be the main contact for the person with dementia. You have a responsibility to consider the impact of mental health symptoms and medication on the person's function. You know, they're looking at their sleep pattern, so you might help them with sleep hygiene tasks in terms of improving their sleep, because sleep's an occupation. Low or high mood, looking at helping them with their anxiety and their levels of motivation. Being aware of disorientation, confusion and perceptual problems. And looking at whether they have an inability to retain new behaviours. So if you're giving them adaptive equipment, then are they able to take in that information? Are they able to utilise that? Are they able to use it appropriately? The initial role of OT is important to remember that some activities will be affected but others are not. So you're looking for a strengths-based approach. So you're looking at highlighting clients' strengths and abilities. And you're also looking to have the minimal possible intervention with the maximal outcome. So you're not looking to swoop in and you'll provide lots and lots of support, because actually what that can do is that can actually disable the person, so they can actually withdraw if you're providing too much support. So it's about that balance, and it's about your clinical reasoning, constantly you're adjusting and changing and thinking about what level of support you're giving. So don't bombard clients with services. The aim is to allow people to maintain their own independence as long as possible so that they're able to safely and confidently carry out their occupations. So I said earlier on, we'll use AMPs or other functional assessments. We quite often we'll use things like memory aids, so calendars. I don't know about you, but I couldn't live without my calendar in my computer at work, my calendar on my phone. Even when the food bin goes out, that's on my phone. When the glass bin goes out, that's in my phone. So, these strategies are really, really helpful in terms of we can use them with clients. Written prompts, visitors' books. Sometimes people use post-it notes. One of the things with that is just to be mindful that it doesn't become overwhelming. Post-it notes can be helpful in short supply, but if it ends up looking like, you're trying to catch flies with fly paper, then it can actually be overwhelming and contraindicated. You can use compensatory strategies, using activity analysis to grade and modify activities to allow people to continue to engage in occupations even though they might have deteriorated. And looking at education of carers, so looking at how carers can support clients, looking at carers making sure that they take care of themselves, because if carers break down or carers become unwell, then they can't provide support to their loved ones. And I think sometimes actually just acknowledging that, and it's a difficult word for people to think about, but it's a burden. Actually living with someone who has dementia and taking care of them, it's a burden. And I think acknowledging that and allowing them not to feel guilty about that, because I think what happens is oftentimes carers feel guilty for thinking it's a burden or for resenting it, and it's perfectly natural that they feel like that. So it's just allowing them to have a reasonable appraisal of the situation, and locating and initiating occupational supports where appropriate. Oh, I missed out group work and cognitive stimulation therapy. Okay, so in terms of occupational therapy interventions, they identified as they should provide individual group interventions to encourage older people to identify, construct, rehearse and carry out daily routines and activities that help to maintain or improve their health and well-being. Occupational therapy interventions and physical activity interventions to promote the mental well-being of older people in primary care and residential care. Occupational therapy aims for clients with dementia, maximising function. So basically maintaining their existing occupations, building on those occupations, trying to maintain them as long as possible to try and delay the process of the disease, with minimal possible intervention. Obviously that increases as time goes on, but initially less is more. Helping people to maintain, restore and improve occupational performance, which will help promote people's health and quality of life, ease caregiver stress, explore the emotions that memory loss and diagnosis can evoke. So actually kind of having that discussion with clients and not being afraid of that. At the mid-stage, individuals may lose most awareness of recent experience and events as well as of their surroundings. They may struggle to recollect their personal history, although they generally recall their own name, occasionally forget the name of their spouse or primary caregiver, need help getting dressed properly, experience disruption of their normal sleep-waking cycle, need help with toileting, experiencing significant personality changes and behavioural symptoms, tend to wander and become lost. I remember actually hearing a really upsetting example of a client who, it was their daughter, used to go and see them, and it got to a stage where they didn't recognise their daughter, and they actually were speaking to their daughter in a way that you wouldn't expect a father to do so, and that was really, really difficult for the family to deal with that and to process that. So it's a really, really horrible, horrible disease for everyone involved. In terms of what we're now looking at is we've had the five pillars for the early stages of people with dementia. They're now looking at pilots in five areas. If I remember, it's Glasgow City, North Lanarkshire, Moray, Highlands, and I can't remember what the other one is, but there's pilots of Alzheimer's Scotland have created the eight pillars, and that's about for people at kind of mid to more kind of severe stages of dementia, and that's there's not a lot of evidence around about that now. So what the Scottish Government have actually done is they've implemented that on a pilot across different sites, so across urban sites, rural sites, trying to build an evidence base to see whether the eight pillar model is helpful. But again, that was developed by Alzheimer's Scotland in collaboration with clients and service users. So in terms of the role of OT in mid-stages, reassess using the same assessment measure, so you get an idea of change over time. So you get a baseline and then you get a change. So it gives you an idea of whether there's been a decrease in function and how severe that decrease in function is, and whether that then means that your intervention needs to increase, or whether your support needs to increase, what changes has to be made to the person's care plan. And more specific advice for carers, how to enable clients with ADLs. So as the disease progresses, people are functional ability becomes less. So they might carers might need more specific advice round about managing personal care. So how we achieve that? Simplify and modify activities to allow client to still maintain participation. Environmental adaptations, so maybe fit adaptive aids or equipment. Risk assessment and management, maybe using things like isolators for gas cookers, smart technologies, you know, things like GPS for people wandering, or door sensors to identify people who have walked out the door. There are things like water sensors to see baths have overflowed, bed sensors to see people have got up during the night and wandered. There's lots and lots of different telecare technologies that can be used. And continuing to work with carers in terms of their education throughout the process. In terms of carer education, it shouldn't be a static thing, it should be continuous throughout the process. So you should continue to educate and support the carers. So, what I would like you to do is, in your group, in peers, I would like you to develop a list of questions that you may ask as an occupational therapist. Doesn't need to be someone with dementia. It could just be what questions you would ask someone on an initial assessment, or it can just be questions in general. I thought it'd be more helpful if it was questions you might ask as an OT. So you might want to think about occupational profile kind of type outline for that. I want you to come up with a minimum of 10 questions, and then once you have your 10 questions, you're going to take turns. So one person is going to be the client, and whilst they're going to try and do is they're going to try and do a word search whilst the therapist is firing questions at them constantly. Okay? So I don't want you to, if you're the therapist, I don't want you to be waiting for the person to give you the answer. If they're having a delay in giving you the answer, I want you to ask the question again. And then as soon as you've got the answer for that question, I want you to ask the next question, and the next question, and the next question. Does that make sense? Okay. Where are my notes? So if you come up with your questions just now, and I will distribute the...